town like when you're driving a Range Rover.
Been driving the new sights,
and I've been kicking the new knowledge.
And I see to a degree that you can't get in college.
It's the sound of science. The sound of science.
Yes, as always, a big cuddly thanks to the Brekkie crew for kickstarting the day. Now, down that last gulp of Nescafe and slurp the dregs of your Coco Pops and pay attention, because up next, it's Discovery, the National Science Radio Show. We've got secret codes in your printouts, a very small car, and, of course, lots of science news. So stick around.
Hello and welcome.
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 Stand and welcome.
Hello, good evening and welcome
to Discovery.
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 Listen to Discovery.
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 Sounds like a lot of fun.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now.
Now, to the speeded up brain of a user, that sound lasts for 4 hours and sounds like this.
Discovery.
Yeah. Welcome to Discovery, the only half hour on radio today that knows its quarks from its quasars, can tell a lepton from a lemming, and can still pronounce deoxyribonucleic acid after a few beers. Yep, geeks every one of us. I'm Chris Stewart, presenter geek for this episode, and in the disco lounge tonight we've got Matt Clark, Ian Wolf, and behind the desk with the buttons and the slidey things, Jackie Pfeffer. In this edition of Discovery, we'll be exposing the spooks in your printer and taking a test drive in a nano car. But first, Ian Wolf with the latest science news.
Nippon Telegraph and Telephone Corporation in Atsugi, Japan, have developed a way to remotely control humans with an electric skull cap. A technology called galvanic vestibular stimulation sends a very low voltage electric current from the back of your ears through your head, either from the left to the right or the right to the left, depending on which way the joystick on a remote control is moved. People wearing the skullcap feel off balance unless they move in the remotely determined direction. The electrical signal messes with the delicate nerves inside the ear that help maintain balance, falsely convincing the person they'll fall over if they don't comply. The phenomenon is painless but dramatic and below the level of conscious thought. Your feet move before you're even aware of it. Subjects report that it feels as though an invisible hand were reaching inside their brain. James Collins, professor of biomedical engineering at Boston University, has studied using the technology to prevent the elderly from falling. NTT researchers say they were able to make a person walk along a route in the shape of a giant pretzel using this technique. They hook it up to video games so that people sway with the movement of the on-screen racing cars and synchronize it with music to force them to move with the music. Senior NTT researcher Taro Maeda says that the music-synchronized effects are like a hypnotic virtual drug experience, but in a good way, and he hopes Apple will include the product in the next iPod earphones. I'm sure the Guantanamo Bay prisoners can't wait for the shiny new headsets with the extra wire. Functional magnetic resonance brain scans have shown that women who don't get moody before menstruation are using their brains differently to women who do get moody. David Silberweg and colleagues at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, New York, scanned the brains of 12 women whose moods remained stable throughout their menstrual cycles. They asked the women to complete a simple cognitive task while they were shown words with neutral, positive, and negative emotional connotations, while they were scanned a week before their periods and a week afterwards. The scan showed that the orbitofrontal cortex, a part of the brain involved in controlling emotions and regulating motivation, was more active during the task in the days before menstruation. After menstruation, that part of the brain was fairly inactive during the task. Silverweg says that the difference in brain activity may buffer the emotional effect of the hormonal changes in these women, helping them to maintain a consistent emotional state. Because this area is kicking in, these women may be able to avoid moodiness across the entire menstrual cycle, he says. For anyone, menstruating or not, who experience moodiness, says Silverweg, this study suggests that there are areas in the brain involved in regulating the emotions that are functioning differently. And since they're functioning differently, they're trainable. The researchers raise the possibility that people can be trained so that their brain works better. Moody people might be able to activate the buffer zones in their brains and iron out the moodiness. The new cognitive behavioral therapy is now the focus of their research.
That was the Discovery Science News with Ian Wolfe. Well, last week on the Discovery News, we had a bit of a disturbing story about, well, let's put it this way. If you think that you're anonymous by having printed out something without your name on it and sent it off to the government with a big rant on it, you might want to think again, because it's going to depend on what kind of printer you've used. They may be able to look at it with a really, really fine microscope-style thing and figure out exactly who you are and where you are and where they can find you. Matt Clark's back again this week to tell us in a bit more detail about this spookiness in our printers. Matt, what's going on?
Yes, Chris, it is a little bit scary. And as I'm researching it further and further, I'm finding it that it's becoming scarier and scarier. As we said, for those who missed the news last week, basically what has happened, and this has all happened 10 years ago, you have to remember that, for the last 10 years, this is what's been going on. Every single time that you have printed something on a laser color printer, it has imprinted a secret code on every single print job that you have done, which reveals your printer's serial number and the date and time of the print.
Every single time.
Every single time. If you have the, of all the major printer manufacturers, like your Xerox, Lexmark, Tektronix, all those big boys who do the high quality color printers, if you've been using one of those and printing anything that's in color, you have imprinted on that a secret code that anyone can read using the right equipment.
Now, this isn't, I'm assuming, a really small, fine letter saying, Matt Clark printed this, go and get him.
Almost.
So what does it look like?
Well, what they come out as very tiny dots, little tiny yellow dots. Now, on a Xerox brand printer, they imprint this code in a grid of 15 by 8. Very tiny dots. It's only about the size of a postage stamp. It's repeated and repeated over and over, at least on the Xerox ones. It's different with the other manufacturers. But it's very, very faint yellow dots that, because the contrast is so small between a white paper or most other print colours that it's printed on top of, it can't be seen with the naked eye. What it can be seen with, however, is if you know those blue lights that they use on CSI or those forensics type shows that sort of...
Ultraviolet.
Oh, not ultraviolet. All you need is a blue light. Uh-huh. So those special blue lens torches, you don't need the special funky goggles that they have. But if you have one of those blue torches and a magnifying glass, you can see the special dots, the special revealing codes on the printouts of your...
So these are actual microdots because they're microscopic dots.
Yes, they're not microdots in the sense of other microdots like they spray on cars and things which have actual data inside them. The dots are the data themselves, the arrangement of the dots. The organisation Electronic Frontiers Foundation has taken up the challenge of decoding these series of dots in the printers. Now, they've only been so far able to decode the dots that are appearing on the Xerox printers, but they have been able to, if you go to their website, www.eff.org, you can see an example of what they actually look like and how the code is worked out. But it's one thing to have a code of your serial number. You might think, oh, big deal. Someone can find out my serial number or the time, or the date and time that I printed something out. But it actually is a big deal because for what most people don't know is when you buy a printer, especially if you're a company or if you buy any high-end type of printer, the place that you bought it from is going to record some details, even if it's only your Visa card number. And so what can happen, let's say you start, let's say you're a member of the Falun Gong or something like that, and the Chinese government gets a hold of this printout that you've stuck on the side of their embassy or something like that, they can take it, get a blue light from Dick Smith and a microscope, or not even, just a magnifying glass, they don't even need a microscope, and they can decode the series of dots on the printout, ring up the manufacturer, if they have an agreement with their manufacturer, and say, I know the serial number of this printout, Can you please tell me who this printer belongs to?
And they can come and get you.
And they can come and get you. They can come to your house and...
I've just had a really good idea. You know how on word processors you can put a picture in the background of whatever you're printing? You can put a, what do they call them, watermark?
Yes.
Why can't you just do a watermark, which is a whole grid of yellow dots? That'd stuff them up.
It would, but it would defeat the purpose of whatever you were trying to...
No, just really fine, just really light yellow. Just, you know, the same as their little dots. And you can just, you know, complete this. Oh,
After all, if you don't see their dots, why would they see yours?
Exactly.
But what the interesting thing is, like I said before, it has been going on for 10 years. And it was all started by the U.S. Secret Service. Now, the U.S. Secret Service approached the printer manufacturers and say, we've got a problem with you guys printing, producing these printers, which are such high quality. Now, we're worried about people... taking them and photocopying our bills and counterfeiting money. So we need a way to track them down. So that's how it all came about.
Thank you very much, Matt Clark. It's nice to know that the Americans are looking out for us and the rest of the world. Doesn't matter that they're infringing our freedom as long as we don't go out there and try to print money on a laser printer. Thanks, Matt.
The Bloodmobile, the Bloodmobile, a delivery service inside us. We begin in the heart's right ventricle and travel to the lungs. Red blood cells get oxygen to take back to the heart. Then from the left side of the heart and out to every cell, delivered by the Bloodmobile.
Somebody's got to haul out the trash to the liver and the kidneys. It's not a pretty job. Carbon dioxide gets carried to the lungs to be exhaled. And the garbage truck is the Bloodmobile.
The Bloodmobile, the Bloodmobile, a delivery service inside us to carry oxygen, nutrients, things that fight infection. Trash collection and deliver the mail. And we're all delivered by the Bloodmobile.
And that funky little ditty was Bloodmobile by the incomparable They Might Be Giants. And you're listening to Discovery all the way around Australia, thanks to 2SER here in Sydney and the Community Broadcasting Network. Well, I've been doing a little bit of reading over the last couple of days of science online, you know, the various science agencies like New Scientist gives lots of interesting stuff during the week. Nature does some good news. And I found something at the nature.com website about a really small car. Now, when I was a kid, I used to collect Matchbox cars. I was a bit of a nerd.
So did
I. Don't mind admitting it. And I had to have the luxury ones. That was my thing. But toy cars are one thing. Matchbox cars are one thing. The one that I've been reading about, the nano car, is toy car extraordinaire. This is something else. Bunch of researchers over in the States, and of course it would be over in the States, have made what is conceivably the smallest car you could possibly make. Here's what they did. They made a chassis, which is roughly in the shape of an H, out of carbon atoms. So we're not talking a carbon car. We're talking a car made out of carbon atoms, and this thing is only a couple of nanometers across. How big's a nanometer? It's about 10 atoms. So we're talking a car which is in the order of 20 to 30 atoms across.
How could they possibly put that together?
Well, we'll get to that one in a second. Let me just fill in the details of what this thing looks like. So you've got this frame built out of carbon atoms. That's your frame. That's your axles. You need wheels. They thought to themselves, well, what can we use as wheels? What's something round and the size of a few atoms? I know, we'll use buckyballs. You heard of buckyballs? They're these tiny little soccer balls, which are made out of, again, carbon. And if you put carbon together in the right kind of way, you get a hollow spherical structure called a buckyball. And so you stick one of each of these on the ends of the two axles, and you've got a little car. And so they're looking at this thing going, cool, we made a nano car. What do we do with it now? Well, let's see if we can drive it. How do you drive something that big? Well, there's a little thing called a scanning tunneling microscope. Very similar to what's called an atom probe. Basically, it's a very, very fine needle. And when you bring that needle close to atoms on the surface of a substance and you put an electric field on it, you're able to drag around individual atoms or small groups of atoms by just moving this thing very slowly across the surface. You're not actually grabbing it and dragging it, you're just dragging it with the force of the electromagnetic
force. So you're pulling along like a little red wagon.
Yeah, like a red wagon with a string or something like that, except that this is kind of like, it's kind of like pulling magnets along. They don't actually have to touch, they just have to be close.
Right.
And so they did this with this car. Now, they asked themselves, how do we know that this thing isn't just being dragged across the surface? In other words, how do we know that the wheels are turning? Well, if you think about it for a second, if you've got a car facing forward, it'll tend to roll forward. If you try to drag a car to the side, it's going to be a bit harder. So they found that they were able to move this tiny nano car very easily in the direction that you'd expect if the wheels were turning, but they couldn't move it terribly easily across the surface, you know, by dragging the wheels to the side. It just wasn't working.
So the wheels were turning.
The wheels were definitely turning. They also made a tiny little triangle of carbon with a wheel at each corner. Now, if you think about that for a second, the only thing that that's going to be able to do is turn around in circles.
A donut-mobile.
Basically, a donut-mobile. And so they used their scanning tunneling microscope to test this one out, and indeed, their little tripod car did, in fact, only turn in circles. So the scientists are really excited by this. In fact, the direct quote from Nature.com is, "This is really exciting," says the materials scientist Harry Hess of the University of Florida in Gainesville. Doesn't go on to say why it's exciting. A bunch of scientists standing around going, cool, we made a really small car.
They need tiny roads.
They need tiny roads. But actually, in all seriousness, it's worth having a think about where this could go, because micro machines and nano machines, it's an idea that's been around for a while. And there are a lot of people around the world doing research into making tiny motors. And these motors, sometimes they're powered by lasers, by laser light, using the force inherent in photons and momentum in photons. Sometimes they're powered by biological or chemical processes. And so now you're starting to think about tiny machines. Okay, maybe not a little matchbox Rolls-Royce or something like that, but a little machine which can be powered by a biological or chemical reaction to then drive across a surface or move through some other structure to take things from one place to another. You've got nano trucks and nano trains.
Yeah, what the power of the wheel.
The power of the wheel at the scale of atoms. What a cool idea, wouldn't you say?
Fantastic.
I liked it anyway.
Hello, this is David Bellamy. Honestly, it is. My favourite animal is sea otter, and my favourite community science show, what else but Discovery?
Yes, indeed, you are listening to Discovery. And finally tonight, we've got a little bit of news that didn't quite make the news. Apparently, dolphins and whales, not quite as cuddly as we all thought. Ian?
Well, they indulge in gang warfare. They abuse their women. Some of them being trained as suicide bombers. And now some armed and dangerous members are on the loose looking to kill. They may even be trying to breed a super soldier. These are dolphins. Dolphins off the coast of Western Australia have gangs that negotiate higher order allegiances with each other when they go to war. When dolphins fight over territory and females, they have allied gangs from different regions to come and back them up. Some of these gangs have deals with other groups for support. They're the only non-primate species that seem to be capable of such complex politics. They kidnap young fertile females and assign guards so they can't escape the gang, and then they rape the captives. Dolphin, sorry?
Flipper. Flipper. I'm never going to watch Flipper like this.
Well,
like,
it's not all
again.
Dolphins. These are this particular culture off the coast of West Australia. The American dolphins or the Antarctic, they might be different cultures around the world.
So it's the West Australian dolphins.
For sure.
I always knew they were a bit funny.
Always suspected though.
Yeah.
Well, news from Hawaii that dolphins and false killer whales, and real killer whales, are all part of the oceanic dolphin family, Delphinae. False killer whales and real killer whales eat any prey, including whale species, but dolphins only eat fish. Now, you might think, why am I talking about all the differences? Well, in a sea life park in Hawaii, a 900-kilogram false killer whale and 200-kilogram bottlenose dolphin coupled and produced offspring that not only were healthy, but fertile.
Get out.
This is really one for the geneticist to explain.
Yeah.
So these are wolfins. They have characteristics such as size, weight, and number of teeth that are midway between the differences between their parents.
Is that what they actually call them? Is that the actual sign? That's the name? The...
It's the unscientific
name. If it's
name.
Not, it should be.
Yeah. So it sort of blurs what's a species and what's
weird.
Not.
Because, I mean, of course, you can have a horse and a donkey mate, and they make a mule, but that's not...
They're not fertile. No, these are fertile.
Weird. That's weird.
So on with the killer whales. So dolphins and killer whales not so far apart. ABC recently showed a documentary about the killer whales in Eden off the coast of Western Australia again. Everywhere else in the world for thousands of years, humans and killer whales have been in competition for hunting giant baleen whales. But not in Twofold Bay in Eden, where three generations of the Davidson family had a deal with the local killer whales called the Law of the Tongue. They found if they allowed the orcas to eat the tongue, they'd leave the rest of the giant carcass for the humans. They just wanted the tongue, and the humans didn't need it. The orcas cooperated with the men by alerting them, sometimes in the middle of the night, when whales are nearby, and by towing and guiding the whaling boats out to where the whales had been herded by the orcas. The humans killed the whales that the orcas otherwise wouldn't have, and so both parties gained from the deal.
See, look, intelligent design, you know, just right there.
Intelligent orcas, at least.
Yeah, like you couldn't, like, Darwin, kind of explain that one, you know, that's what I'm
Well, they're adaptive, intelligent hunters.
Ah, right, yeah.
Bit of communication, and away they went.
That's just so cool. It's like you hear about things like dolphin speak and whale speak and scientists who go out and go, ooh, and try to sort of attract the whale. But no, this is real communication here. This is teaming up.
This is team effort like on Sesame Street. But the problem is that, of course, the law of the tongue got broken.
Oh, no.
And somebody decided that they weren't going to leave the whale out for the orcas to get the tongue. And not only was that part of it broken, but somebody went off and killed one of the killer whales. Oh. And that broke the deal and they stopped coming. And that was the end of whaling in Eden. The humans weren't really good enough to whale on their own. And the offshore whalers were killing most of the whales anyway. And that was the end of that. More on killer whales. In Marineland in Ontario, killer whales have invented a new way of getting food independent of their keepers. He's found that if he regurgitates some fish and hides just under the surface, a seabird will fly down to eat the fish so he can leap up out of the water and catch the bird in his jaws.
Love it.
And he's taught his fellow orcas the trick. Now, we haven't seen non-primate species in captivity teaching new tricks to others of their kind.
So you can teach an old murderous thing under the water a new trick, basically.
That's right. Well, the trick is now, is Marineland going to try and stop them from doing this when the school kiddies are visiting? And now onto the military dolphins. Dolphins have been trained by the American and Russian navies since the Cold War, attacking the breathing apparatus of divers, mapping out minefields, and as suicide bombers.
Nice.
Very nice. Strapping on bombs, telling the dolphins where to go.
I've heard about that. The big plus about that, as far as the military is concerned, is that they're not picked up by sonar or other detection devices. And even if they are, they say, oh, it's just a dolphin.
just a dolphin. Going on its merry way. The ABC's foreign correspondent visited the Russian ex-military dolphins. These are the ones that have retired. They're being exploited for new age healing of sick children at $8,000 US a treatment. Unfortunately, the dolphins are large animals that excrete a large amount of waste into the enclosed spaces the children are swimming in, and the kids are getting bacterial infections instead of being healed.
Oh, it's just heartwarming stuff.
It's crazy Russians.
Good science. ABC also visited the Russian Navy, who still run a dolphin training program. Like, the dolphins actually hold things in their flippers. During Hurricane Katrina, American-trained military dolphins were washed out to sea, armed with toxic dart guns for shooting divers who might, or might not, be terrorists. This is where the money went instead of fixing the levees or organising airlifts.
See, this is what Australia needs. Australia doesn't have enough dolphins patrolling the borders armed to the teeth. Do dolphins have teeth?
Well, this is the thing. How do they operate the dart guns? Well, they have cybernetic implants.
Get out.
To let them choose anaesthetizing darts and receive radio instructions.
Of course they do.
Of course they do. And they've got to know where to nudge the unconscious terrorists so they can be interrogated.
Yes, yes. So they can go, what's that? Flip, what's that? You got a terrorist?
So you're saying if we're planning a dive trip to the southwest coast of Florida, it might be a bad idea?
Well, the dolphins are going to run out of darts at some time, and maybe they'll return to their trainers when the hurricane season's over.
That was Ian Wolfe with all of your murderous sea beast news here on Discovery. Indeed, that's pretty much everything for another week of Discovery. If you've enjoyed the show this week, then we'd love it if you drop us a line. The easiest way for you to do that is to send us an email, discovery@2ser.com. Or you can also go to our website, 2ser.com/discovery, where you can check out all the info about the show, but you can also check out our podcast as well. So if you just listen to the show, you can listen to it again, I suppose. I don't know. Something like that. Joining me on the show tonight, we had Newshound Ian Wolfe, Matt Clark, I'm Chris Stewart, of course, and balancing all of this testosterone in the studio this week was our weekly panel goddess, Jackie Pfeffer. You've been listening to Discovery, which is produced weekly in the 2SER studios way up at the top here of UTS Tower, and we're broadcast nationally thanks to the Community Broadcasting Network. Join us all back here same time next week for more sciencey goodness on Discovery.